The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. First, the Mayo Clinic health letter. Second opinion. Question. I was recently diagnosed with breast cancer at age 65. I have a strong family history of the disease. However, my doctor hasn't mentioned genetic counseling or testing. Is this something I should bring up? Answer. Only about 5 to 10% of breast cancer cases are thought to be hereditary, meaning that they result directly from gene defects or mutations passed on from a parent. For that reason, genetic testing isn't routinely recommended. However, women with strong family histories of breast and other related cancers are one of the exceptions to this rule. There are several good reasons to talk with your doctor about testing. A genetic test involves taking a blood or saliva sample and analyzing your DNA for gene mutations that can increase your risk of developing cancer. Ideally, your doctor will first refer you to a genetic counselor who will collect the family history and discuss the risks and benefits of genetic testing. The genetic counselor will also review other important issues associated with testing, such as cost, insurance coverage, and your rights under genetic discrimination laws. Testing may be appropriate when a woman has a personal or family history suggesting an increased risk of breast cancer. Risks include having cancer in both breasts, having a certain subtype of breast cancer, or being younger than 50 when diagnosed. Other red flags include multiple cases of breast, ovarian, or pancreatic cancer on the same side of the family, male breast cancer, or Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. Knowing you have a hereditary mutation can help guide your treatment decisions. For example, if you carry a high-risk mutation, you may feel more comfortable undergoing a mastectomy rather than a lumpectomy. You may also want to consider preventive surgery such as removal of your ovaries or oophorectomy. Ovaries produce estrogen, which in premenopausal women can feed estrogen-sensitive breast cancer. This procedure also lowers your risk of developing ovarian cancer, which has been linked to some of the same mutations as those that cause hereditary breast cancer. Knowing your genetic status may benefit your family as well. If you test positive for a mutation, you can share this information with your relatives to allow them to weigh their own options. However, family members may not want to know. Discuss your decision to test with them and respect their wishes if they don't want to know the results. Whether you decide to test or not, you may want to ask your doctor whether a genetic counselor is available to help you navigate the risks and benefits of genetic testing. Question. I've been taking a prescribed antidepressant for a few years. Should I talk to my doctor about weaning off the drug or just stop? Answer. Talk to your doctor or pharmacist before stopping the drug. Ask whether it's okay to stop taking the drug or if the prescription needs to be refilled for continued use. However, there may also be a need for reevaluation of your health condition by a doctor or a thorough review of drugs you take, so that you're taking only the necessary drugs at appropriate dosages. If drug discontinuation is recommended, a gradual taper is advised for many types of drugs. Common classes of drugs that may require tapering include antidepressants or mood medications, heart medications, seizure medications, longer-term oral steroids, Parkinson's drugs, and longer-term pain meds. Sometimes abruptly stopping a drug is preferred. Your doctor or pharmacist can tell you if a drug can be stopped abruptly with no ill effects. Your doctor or pharmacist may also tell you to abruptly stop taking a drug if it's causing a harmful side effect. Knee resilience, improving function, avoiding pain. The knee joint is the largest and arguably the most complicated force-absorbing joint in the body. Given that, it's not surprising that there are many different causes of knee pain. Pain from arthritis and pain that develops around the front of the knee and kneecap or patellofemoral pain are two of the more common causes in older adults. When it comes to preventing or reducing knee pain resulting from these and other non-traumatic causes, you can try a wide variety of conservative approaches, including weight loss, activity modification, bracing, or use of heat or cold therapy. Another very important pillar of therapy is improving the stability and balance function of the knee. Steps that contribute to this include general strengthening and stretching of muscles. Strengthening of the muscles that support the knee helps reduce stress on the joint. The main targets are the thigh muscles, the quadriceps, the hamstrings at the back of your legs, and the hip and buttock muscles. Improving flexibility of muscles and tendons on the front, back, and sides of your legs helps reduce tightness and enables the muscles to function through their full range of motion. Strengthening of the hip muscles and core muscles also can help correct poor lower extremity movement patterns that contribute to knee pain. Physical therapy techniques. These may include balance training, re-educating improperly functioning muscles, or various manual therapies such as joint mobilization or hands-on soft tissue mobilization to release tight spots of muscle or connective tissue. Below are specific exercises that can help improve the balance, function, and stability of your knee. You can do these exercises 2 or 3 times a week, but avoid doing muscle strength exercises on consecutive days. Start gradually and consider learning how to do these exercises and perhaps others with a physical therapist or fitness professional. The first one is sidestep with exercise band. Begin standing upright with a resistance band looped around your ankles. Bend your knees slightly and keep the hip area square and stable. Slowly step sideways, 1 foot at a time. Make sure to keep your feet pointing forward and try not to let your knees collapse toward inward while stepping. Start with a very lightweight exercise band and try 5 to 10 steps in each direction. Take a short break and repeat this 1 or 2 more times, using a railing or table for support if you feel you need it for balance and safety. As you improve, you can gradually add steps or increase the strength of the resistance band. Finally, seated leg extension. Start seated upright in a chair. Keeping your back straight, slowly straighten one knee so that the leg is straight out in front of you. Hold for a few seconds, then return to the starting position. Repeat this motion 5 to 10 times with each leg to start. Take a short break and repeat this 1 to 2 more times. Long QT syndrome when medication is to blame. After some unexplained fainting spells, you are diagnosed with a disturbance in your heart's electrical system called long QT syndrome. Surprisingly, your doctor thinks the antibiotic you're taking might be to blame. The heart relies on electrical signals to contract and eject blood out of the heart and to the rest of the body. The heart then pauses to recover and refill with blood before contracting again. On an ECG or electrocardiogram, a test that graphs the electrical impulse traveling through the heart, this period of recovery and refill is represented as the time between the beginning of the so-called Q wave to the end of another wave-like bump labeled the T wave. This time period is dubbed the QT interval. If you have long QT syndrome, your heart muscle takes longer to electrically recharge itself, which shows up on an EKG or an ECG as a prolonged QT interval. This delayed recovery sets up the potential for the heart's otherwise normal rhythm to spin electrically out of control into a potentially life-threatening rhythm abnormality. Many people with long QT syndrome never experience signs or symptoms from the disturbance, since the heart stays in the normal rhythm. Others will have signs such as sudden fainting spells that occur without warning, or full-body seizures triggered by exertion or emotion, or they may have the heart rhythm abnormality, arrhythmia, known as torsades de pointes, TDP, one of the most dangerous complications of the syndrome. While long QT syndrome can be inherited, congenital long QT syndrome occurring in about 1 in 2,000 people, long QT syndrome that develops from other factors. Acquired long QT syndrome is more common. Medications that aggravate the QT interval are the most frequent cause of the acquired long QT syndrome, but the condition can also develop because of a wide variety of underlying diseases and electrolyte imbalances, especially low body potassium or hypokalemia. The types of medications that underlie acquired long QT syndrome include heart rhythm drugs, antidepressants and antipsychotics, antibiotics, diuretics, and cancer-fighting medications. In a 2016 study, almost 60% of older adults were taking a drug capable of prolonging QT interval, and almost 25% were taking two or more simultaneously, a practice that can increase the risk of drug-induced TDP, the cardiac arrest rhythm. The medication trigger. Quinidine, a drug used to treat irregular heart rhythms, was the first medication linked to prolonged QT intervals almost a century ago. Today, more than 100 other drugs have also been tied to an increased risk. Most of these medications have a common link. They block or disrupt a pathway or channel for potassium transmission out of cells, which interrupts the heart's normal electrical recharging system. It's important to note that most people taking these drugs don't develop a prolonged QT interval or experience TDP. However, it's a good idea to be aware of your risk, as trying to predict who will be affected can be difficult. Overall, your risk of experiencing a prolonged QT interval or TDP increases if you're on a QT prolonging drug and one or more of the following factors or conditions are present: congenital long QT syndrome causing genetic mutation, being older, being female, electrolyte imbalances such as low potassium or magnesium, may occur after episodes of vomiting or diarrhea, cardiovascular issues such as heart failure, heart attack, or slow heart rate, bradycardia, kidney disease, hypothyroidism. If you have any of these risk factors, work with your doctor to exercise caution when taking medications that are capable of affecting the heart's electrical system and prolonging the QT interval. The risk of long QT syndrome must be weighed against the benefits of taking a particular drug. If you've been diagnosed with acquired long QT syndrome, your doctor may want to reduce your drug dose or prescribe a different drug. Any electrolyte imbalances will need to be treated. These are key treatment strategies for this form of long QT syndrome. If you're taking QT prolonging medication, your doctor may recommend baseline and follow-up ECG and offer guidance on recognizing symptoms of an arrhythmia and when you should seek medical help. Are you at risk? The website www.crediblemeds.org maintains a free database of medications capable of prolonging the QT interval. The site, under contract with the Food and Drug Administration, groups drugs into four categories based on their risks of causing the cardiac arrest rhythm called TDP, torsades de pointes. You can search for individual medications or view all the medications listed on each category. The lists are updated every 4 to 8 weeks. If a medication you're taking appears on the Credible Meds site and you're concerned that you may be at risk for a drug-induced long QT syndrome, talk with your doctor or pharmacist about your risk and whether safer alternatives are available. News in our views, tick bite causes meat allergy. A little known side effect that can occur weeks to months after being bitten by a particular type of tick is the development of an allergy to meat. Scientists have observed a strong association between the tick bite and increased sensitivity to meat such as beef, pork, and lamb. The allergic reaction, which tends to occur between 2 and 6 hours after eating meat, produces swelling, itchy hives, and abdominal pain or indigestion. In some cases, symptoms may progress to anaphylactic shock, which can be life-threatening. On the other hand, symptoms may not occur every time meat is eaten. Scientists believe when certain ticks bite, they may inject a substance into the body that, in some people, creates an overabundance of antibodies to a sugar molecule called galactose alpha 1, 3-galactose alpha-gal. This alpha-gal sugar is present in meat. Once a person is sensitized to alpha-gal through the tick bite, eating this type of meat can produce an allergic reaction, alpha-gal syndrome. An association between tick bites and red meat allergies was first documented in Australia around 2006. Since then, similar cases have been reported in France, Sweden, Germany, Japan, and the United States. In the U.S., the Lone Star tick appears to cause the allergy. The Lone Star tick is named for the single yellow spot on the female's back. It's prevalent in the central and southern U.S., but can be found as far north as Maine and as far west as Texas. Alpha-gal syndrome is still relatively rare, but appears to be increasing. Avoiding meat, especially the fatty portions, is enough for some people to avoid a reaction. For others, it may be necessary to also avoid dairy foods and even gelatin and other foods that may contain meat products. No vaccine or cure is available, but symptoms may decrease over time. Unfortunately, exposure to new Lone Star tick bites can reactivate the syndrome. Research into alpha-gal is ongoing. The Harvard Health Letter. Insider tips to maximize your doctor visit. Here's what Harvard physicians advise you to do at your next appointment. You know the routine. You're waiting in the exam room, and your doctor comes in for what seems like a very quick visit before leaving to see the next person. You're left feeling that you didn't ask all your questions or get a good understanding of your treatment plan. What happened? We're under incredible pressure, and we're scrutinized to be sure we're seeing enough patients, explains geriatrician Dr. Suzanne Salomon, an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. We don't have many minutes, and yet we have to go over each person's medical issues, medications, and even end-of-life issues. That doesn't leave a lot of time to talk. The scenario is the new reality of medicine. Research suggests that average length of a doctor visit ranges from 10 to 20 minutes. While that can be challenging for both you and your doctor, the way to make it work is to maximize every minute. You can do that by adopting as many of the following strategies as possible. Prepare and prioritize questions. Create and bring a list of questions you have for the doctor so you won't forget to ask them. Prioritize your list with the most urgent questions at the top. If you bring in a list of 10 questions and there may not be enough time to get through all 10, so start with the most important, Dr. Salomon advises. Your doctor may be able to plan some time for questions if you announce that you have a list at the beginning of the appointment. Send records or tests ahead of time. When you see a new doctor, particularly a specialist, he or she will likely want to see prior medical records and tests related to your health condition. It's most useful to have the actual test results when possible, above and beyond someone else's interpretation of those tests, so the physician has the opportunity to see and interpret those same studies personally as well, says Dr. Christopher D. Giovanni, an orthopedic surgeon and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Ask about the best way to forward your records to the doctor when you make the appointment. In this day of electronic medical records, a specialist in the same medical group, hospital, or healthcare system will have computer access to medical records, but a specialist elsewhere may not. You should check with the doctor's office about this in advance. Ask a buddy to go with you. It helps to have someone with you to serve as another set of ears. Older patients may have hearing impairment and may not feel comfortable asking doctors to repeat themselves, or they may have undetected cognitive impairment and won't remember or understand what the doctor said, explains Dr. Gad Marshall, a neurologist and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Or you may be emotionally distressed and unable to take in everything the doctor is saying. It can help to have another person along to ask the doctor to clarify or repeat information, or at least take notes. Bring your medications to the appointment. You may think you know your medications well, but do you know the names and dosages? I suggest that you routinely bring in the bottles with your medications, both prescriptions and over-the-counter. This may reveal that you are not taking the medications your doctor thinks you should take. It also gives you the opportunity to understand what every medication is being used for, says Dr. Sarah Berry, a geriatrician and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. You can also discuss if any medications can be reduced or eliminated. Arrive early. Arriving before your actual appointment time gives you a chance to fill out paperwork, go to the bathroom if necessary, and knock out some of the routine steps of the visit, like a blood pressure check. If I'm in the room at 10 for a 10 a.m. appointment, but the patient isn't there waiting because he only just arrived or he's in the bathroom, we're losing minutes, Salomon says. She recommends arriving 15 to 20 minutes early. Expect a long wait. Despite an earlier arrival, you may wind up waiting longer than anticipated if your doctor falls behind schedule. Why does this happen? We cannot predict who is coming in the door or how simple or complex the problem is. Some days a provider might be ahead of schedule, sometimes on time, and unfortunately, often a bit behind just to be able to see everyone who needs to be seen, says Dr. DeGiovanni. But take heart. I've also found that when patients realize you are acting in their best interest and are always willing to spend whatever time it takes to care for their problem on any given visit, these people almost never mind waiting at subsequent visits. They understand that you're doing the same for everyone. He suggests that you bring some reading or work material so that you can use the time well regardless of the wait. Prepare an elevator speech. When your doctor walks into the room and asks how you're feeling or why you're here, answer with a detailed yet concise explanation. In the business world, it's called an elevator speech, an effective summary that lasts about the length of an elevator ride. Make it 1 minute or less if you can, advises Dr. Salomon. Telling long stories would be great if we were going to dinner, but they have no place in a doctor's office. Coming up with your elevator speech may be tough on the spot, so prepare it before the appointment. Dr. Salomon recommends including the reason for your visit, what your symptoms are, and if there's anything stressful going on in your personal life that would affect your health, like a divorce, job change, or move. If you're seeing a doctor who's taken care of you before, include only the pertinent information that's developed since your last visit, such as a new health condition or medication you're taking. Don't hold back information. People get embarrassed and may leave out things that could be really important, like alcohol or marijuana use. They may not want the doctor to make judgments, but you really do need to be upfront about what's going on, Dr. Salomon says. Other topics that may be difficult to talk about include depression, sexual dysfunction, and incontinence. If you feel awkward, remember that you have only a limited amount of time with an expert who can help you. It's up to you to get as much as you can from the visit. Ask the Doctor, by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, Editor-in-Chief. Should I worry about grandkids' sports? I keep hearing that concussions can cause problems later in life. Should I be concerned about my grandkids playing sports, particularly football? Answer. Sports teach kids many important life lessons, like the value of teamwork and hard work, and the importance of tenacity and resilience. The most popular sport in the United States is football, yet evidence has emerged that repeated head injuries common in football may lead to a brain disease called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. This disease, which currently can be diagnosed only at an autopsy, causes difficulty thinking, severe mood swings, anger, violence, and death. Should you worry about your grandkids playing football? There is no absolute scientific proof that playing football will lead to CTE, and we are unlikely to ever get such absolute proof. That would require a study of very large numbers of children, assigning them at random to either play football or not for the next 30 years. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in July 2017 attracted a lot of attention and concern. The families of 202 former football players, high school, college, and post-college, asked experts to examine the brains of their loved ones after they died to find out if the players had CTE. The disease was diagnosed in 87% of them. It was more common in those who had played football the longest. Of the 111 National Football League players whose brains were autopsied, all but one had the disease. Since the former players in this study were brought to the attention of the research team because of the behavior that suggested they had suffered from CTE, the study cannot estimate what the risk of CTE might be in all football players or in kids who engage in other sports that put them at risk for repeated head injury, like boxing. In my mind, the most important sport to study because of its enormous global popularity and its increasing popularity in the United States is soccer. The headers can involve head trauma. A curious statistic in the JAMA study was that players with the mildest degree of disease had died at an average age of 44, whereas players with the most severe disease had died at an average age of 71. Why would those with the mildest disease die sooner? The most common cause of death for those with the most severe disease was dementia. For those with the mildest disease, the most common cause of death was suicide. Perhaps those who committed suicide felt they could see the future. Would I discourage my grandkids from playing football? In the absence of definitive evidence, I would make the most prudent recommendation I could. I would urge their parents to guide them to a different sport. Sir, sugary drink consumption appears to be down, but is it low enough? Here's some encouraging news about how many sugary drinks we're guzzling in the United States. An observational study led by Harvard researchers published online November 14, 2017, by obesity suggests that consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages fell significantly between 2004 and 2014. Researchers looked at data collected from more than 18,000 children and teens and more than 27,000 adults ages 20 or older. Every 2 years, people were asked about the kinds of drinks they'd had in the previous 24 hours, such as soda or juice. About 60% of kids and 50% of adults reported drinking a sugary beverage on any given day in 2014, down from 80% of kids and about 62% of adults in 2004. The percentage of adults ages 60 or older who reported drinking a sugary beverage on any given day dropped from 46% in 2004 to 39% in 2014. While the declines are a step in the right direction, consumption of these drinks was still highest among those at higher risk for obesity, such as African Americans and Hispanic participants across all age groups. Remember, the average can of soda has about 40 grams of added sugar, far more than the American Heart Association recommended, the limit of 24 grams of added sugar per day for women and 36 grams per day for men. We've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, if you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.